Forrester called. His voice was just loud enough to go over the babble in the room.
"Apollo Recovery Fleet," came the answer, "and we've lost communications with them. Last words we got were, fireball southeast, then fireball overhead, then nothing."
"Thank you," Forrester said.
"Houston? Houston, there is a large strike in the Gulf of Mexico. I say again, large strike 300 miles southeast of you. Request you send a helicopter for our families."
"Jesus, how can Baker be so calm about it?" someone demanded. "What damn fool is that?" Sharps wondered. "New man. Never heard the astronauts when there's a real problem." He glanced over to Forrester. Dan Forrester nodded.
"The hammer has fallen," he said.
Then all the TV screens went blank, and the loudspeakers hissed with static. 2,000 miles northeast of Pasadena, in a concrete-lined hole 50 feet below ground, Major Bennett Roston idly fingered the .38 on his hip. He caught himself and put his hands on the Minuteman missile launch control console. They strayed restlessly for a moment, then one went to the key on its chain around his neck. "Bloody hell," Roston thought. "The old man's got me nervous." He had justification. The night before, he'd got a call directly from General Thomas Bambridge, and the SAC commander-in-chief didn't often speak personally to missile squadron commanders. Bambridge's message had been short.
"I want you in the hole tomorrow," he'd said. "And for your information, I'll be up in Looking Glass myself."
"Goddamn," Major Roston had answered.
"Sir, is this the big one?"
"Probably not," Bambridge had answered, and then he'd gone on to explain. Which wasn't, Roston thought, very reassuring. If the Ruskies really thought the U.S. was blind and crippled... He glanced to his left. His deputy, Captain Harold Luce, was at another console just like Roston's. The consoles were deep underground, surrounded by concrete and steel, built to withstand a near miss by an atomic bomb. It took both men to launch their birds. Both had to turn keys and punch buttons, and the timing sequence was set so that one man couldn't do it alone. Captain Luce was relaxed at his console. Books were spread out in front of him, a correspondence course in Oriental art history. Collecting correspondence degrees was the usual pastime for men on duty in the holes, but how could Luce do it today, when they were unofficially on alert?
"Hey, Hal," Roston called.
"Yo, Skipper. You're supposed to be alert."
"I am alert. Nothing's going to happen. You watch."
"Christ, I hope not." Roston thought about his wife and 4 children in Missoula. They'd hated the idea of moving to Montana, but now they loved it. Big country, open skies, no big city problems.
"I wish..." He was interrupted by the impersonal voice from the wire-grilled covered speaker above him.
"EWO. EWO," the voice said. "Emergency war orders. Emergency war orders. This is no drill. Authentication 78-43-76854-87902-1735 Zulu. Red alert. Red alert. Your condition is red."
Sirens screamed through the concrete bunker. Major Roston hardly noticed as a sergeant came down the steel ladder to the entrance and slammed shut the big Mosler Safe Company bank vault door. The sergeant closed it from the outside and twirled the combination dial. No one would get into the hole without blasting. Then, as regulations required, the sergeant cocked his submachine gun and stood with his back to the big safe door. His face was hard, and he stood rigidly, swallowing the sharp knot of fear. Inside, Roston punched the authentication numbers into his console and opened the seals on an envelope from his order book. Luce was doing the same thing at his console.
"I certify that the authentication is genuine," Luce said.
"Right. Insert,"
Roston ordered. Simultaneously, they took the keys from around their necks and put them into the red-painted lot switches on their consoles. Once inserted and turned to the first click, the keys couldn't be withdrawn without other keys neither Luce nor Roston had. SAC procedures.
"On my count," said Roston. "One, two..."
They turned the keys 2 clicks. Then they waited. They did not turn them further. Yet. It was mid-morning in California. It was evening in the Greek Isles. The last of the sun's disk had vanished as two men reached the top of the granite knob. In the east, a first star showed. Far below them, Greek peasants were driving overloaded donkeys through a maze of low stone walls and vineyards. The town of Akrotira lay in twilight. Incongruities. White, mud-walled houses that might have been created 10,000 years ago. The Venetian fortress at the top of its hill. The modern school near the ancient Byzantine church. And below that, the camp where Willis and MacDonald were uncovering Atlantis. The site was almost invisible from the hilltop. In the west, a star switched on and off instantly. Blink. Then another. "It started," MacDonald said. Wheezing, Alexander Willis settled himself on the rock. He was mildly irritated. The hour's climb had left him breathless, though he was 24 years old and considered himself in good shape. But MacDonald had led him all the way and helped him over the top, and MacDonald, whose dark red hair had receded to expose most of his darkly tanned scalp, was not even breathing hard. MacDonald had earned his strength. Archaeologists work harder than ditch diggers. The two sat cross-legged, looking west, watching the meteors. They were 2,800 feet above sea level on the highest point of the strange island of Thera. The granite knob had been called many things by a dozen civilizations, and it had endured much. Now it was known as Mount Prophet Elias. Dusk faded on the waters of the bay far below. The bay was circular, surrounded by cliffs 1,000 feet high, the caldera of a volcanic explosion that destroyed 2/3 of the island, destroyed the Minoan Empire, created the legends of Atlantis. Now a new black island, evil in appearance and barren, rose in the center of the bay. The Greeks called it the New Burnt Land, and the islanders knew that someday it, too, would explode, as Thera had exploded so many times before. Fiery streaks reflected in the bay. Something burned blue-white overhead. In the west, the golden glow faded, not to black, but to a strange curdled green and orange glow, a backdrop for the meteors. Once again, Phaeton drove the chariot of the sun. The meteors came every few seconds. Ice chips struck atmosphere and burned in a flash. Snowballs streaked down, burning greenish-white. Earth was deep in the coma of Hamner Brown. "Funny hobby for us," said Willis. "Sky-watching. I've always loved the sky," MacDonald said. "You don't see me digging in New York, do you? The desert places where the air's clear, where men have watched the stars for 10,000 years. That's where you find old civilizations. But I've never seen the sky like this."
"I wonder what it looked like after you-know-what."
MacDonald shrugged in the near dark.
"Plato didn't describe it, but the Hittites said a stone god rose from the sea to challenge the sky. Maybe they saw the cloud, or there are things in the Bible. You could take them as eyewitness accounts, but from a long way away. You wouldn't have wanted to be near when Pharaoh went off."
Willis didn't answer, and, small wonder, a great greenish light drew fire across the sky, moving up, lasting for seconds before it burst and died. Willis found himself looking east. His lips pursed in a soundless O. Then,
"Mac, turn around."
MacDonald turned. The curdled sky was rising like a curtain. You could see beneath the edge. The edge was perfectly straight, a few degrees above the horizon. Above was the green and orange glow of the comet's coma. Below, blackness in which stars glowed. "The Earth's shadow," MacDonald said, "a shadow cast through the coma. I wish my wife had lived to see this. Just another year." A great light glared behind them. Willis turned. It sank slowly, too bright to see, blinding, drowning the background. Willis stared into it.
God, what was it?
Sinking. Faded. "I hope you hid your eyes," MacDonald said. Willis saw only agony. He blinked. It made no difference. He said,
I think I'm blind.
He reached out, patted rock, seeking the reassurance of a human hand. Softly, MacDonald said, I don't think it matters. Rage flared and died. That quickly, Willis knew what he meant. MacDonald's hands took his wrists and moved them around a rock. Hug that tight. I'll tell you what I see.
Right.
MacDonald's speech seemed hurried. When the light went out, I opened my eyes. For a moment, I think I saw something like a violet searchlight beam going up. Then it was gone. But it came from behind the horizon. We'll have some time. Fair as a bad luck island, Willis said. He could see nothing, not even darkness. Did you ever wonder why they still build here? Some of the houses are hundreds of years old. Eruptions every few centuries, but they always come back. For that matter, what are we doing? Alex, I can see the tidal wave. It gets taller every second. I don't know if it'll reach this high or not. Brace yourself for the air shock wave, though.
Ground shock first. I guess this is the end of Greek civilization.
I suppose so. And a new Atlantis legend, if anyone lives to tell it. The curtain's still rising. Streamlines from the nucleus in the west. Earth's black shadow in the east. Meteors everywhere. MacDonald's voice trailed off.
What?
I closed my eyes, but it was northeast and huge.
Greg, who named Mount Prophet Elias? It's too bloody appropriate.
The ground shock ripped through and beneath Thera, through the magma channel that the seabed had covered 3,500 years before. Willis felt the rock wrench at his arms. Then Thera exploded. A shockwave of live steam laced with lava tore him away and killed him instantly. Seconds later, the tsunami rolled across the raw orange wound. Nobody would live to tell of the second Thera explosion. Mabel Hawker fanned her cards and smiled inwardly. 20 points. Her hand was a good one. Her partner, unfortunately, wasn't. The way B. Anderson was bidding, they'd be out $100 by the time the plane landed at JFK. The 747 was high above New Jersey in its descent into New York. Mabel and Chet and the Andersons were seated around a table in the first class section, too far from the windows to see anything. Mabel regretted the bridge game. She'd never seen New York from the air, but she didn't want the Andersons to know that. The windows flashed again. "Your bid, May," Chet said. People in the window seats were craning out. First class buzzed with voices, and Mabel heard the fear that lies buried in every passenger's mind. She said, "Sorry, 2 diamonds."
4 hearts, B. Anderson said, and Mabel cringed. There was a soft ping, the sign lit, "Fasten seatbelts."
"This is Captain Farrar," said a friendly voice. "We don't know what that flash was, but we'll ask you to fasten your seatbelts, just in case. Whatever it was a long way behind us."
The pilot's voice was very calm and reassuring. Did B have a jump bid? Oh, Lord, did she even know what an opening 2 diamonds meant? Have to bullet through. There was a sound, like something very large being slowly torn in two. Suddenly the 747 was laboring, surging forward. She'd read that experienced travelers kept their seatbelts fastened loosely, so she had done that. Now Mabel deliberately unfastened the belt, laid her cards face down, and lurched toward a pair of empty window seats.
"Mother, should you do that?" Chet asked.
Mabel winced. She hated being called Mother. It sounded country hick. She sprawled across the seats and looked out. The big plane nosed down, diving, as the pilots tried to compensate for a sudden tailwind moving nearly with the speed of the plane. The wings lost all lift. The 747 fell like a leaf, yawing, lurching, as the pilots fought to hold her. Mabel saw New York City ahead in the distance. There was the Empire State Building, there the Statue of Liberty, there the World Trade Center, looking just as she'd imagined them, but poking out of a landscape tilted at 45 degrees. Somewhere out there her daughter would be going to JFK to meet her parents and introduce the boy she was going to marry. Flaps were sliding from the wing's trailing edge. The plane lurched and shuddered, and Mabel's cards flew like startled butterflies. She felt the plane surging upward, pulling out of its dive. Far above, black clouds ran like a curtain across the sky, faster than the plane, sparking with lightning as they moved. Lightning everywhere. An enormous bolt struck the Statue of Liberty and played along the Grand Dame's upraised torch. Then lightning struck the plane. Beyond Ocean Boulevard, there was a bluff. At the bottom of the bluff, the Pacific Coast Highway, and then the sea. At the edge of the bluff, the bearded man watched the horizon with a look of surpassing joy. The light had flashed only for a second or two, but blindingly. Its after-image was a blue balloon in the bearded man's field of view. A red glow, strange lighting effects outlining a vertical pillar. He turned with a happy smile.
"Pray," he called. "The day of judgment is here."
A dozen passers-by had stopped to stare. Mostly they ignored him, though he was a most impressive figure, with his eyes glowing with happiness and his thick black beard marked with two snow-white tufts at the chin. But one turned and answered,
"It's your day of judgment if you don't step back. Earthquake!"
The bearded man turned away. The black man in the expensive business suit called more urgently,
"If you're on the cliff when it falls, you'll miss most of Judgment Day. Come on now."
The bearded man nodded, as if to himself. He turned and strolled back to join the other on the sidewalk.
"Thank you, brother." The earth shuddered and groaned.
The bearded man kept his feet. He saw that the man in the brown suit was kneeling, and now he knelt, too. The earth shook, and parts of the bluff fell away. It would have carried the bearded man with it if he hadn't moved.
"For he cometh," the bearded man shouted. "For he cometh to judge the earth."
The businessman joined in the psalm.
"And with the righteousness to judge the world, and the peoples with his truth."
Others joined. The heaving earth buckled and rolled.
"Glory be to the Father, and—"
A sharp, sudden shock threw them to the ground. They scrambled back to their knees. The shaking stopped, and some of the group hurried away, looking for cars, running inland.
"O ye heavens, bless ye the Lord," the bearded man cried.
Those who had stayed joined in the canticle. The responses were easy to learn, and the bearded man knew all the versicles. There were surfers out in the water. They had floated through the violent upheavals. Now they were invisible in a blinding curtain of salt rain. Many of the bearded man's group ran away into the wet darkening. Still, he prayed, and others from the apartments across the street joined him.
"O ye seas and floods, bless ye the Lord! Praise him and magnify him forever!"
The rains came hard, but just in front of the bearded man and his flock, a trick combination of winds drove a clear path that let them see down the bluff to the deserted beach. The waters were receding, boiling away to leave small things flopping on the rainy, wet sands.
"O ye whales, and all that move in the waters, bless ye the Lord!"
The canticle ended. They knelt in the driving rain and flashing lightning. The bearded man thought he saw, far away, through the rain and beyond the receding waters. Beyond that, to the horizon, the ocean was rising in a hump, a straight wall across the world.
"Save us, O God, for the waters are come in, even unto my soul," the bearded man cried.
The others did not know the psalm, but they listened quietly. An ominous rumble came from the ocean.
"I stick fast in the deep mire where no ground is. I am come into deep waters so that the floods run over me."
But no, the bearded man thought, the rest of that psalm is not appropriate. Not at all. He began again.
"The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want."
The water rushed forward. They finished the psalm. One of the women stood.
"Pray now,"
the bearded man said. The noise from the sea drowned out all other words, and a curtain of rain swept over them. Warm rain to hide the sea and waves. It came in a rush, a towering wall of water higher than the highest buildings. An onrushing juggernaut of water, foaming gray and white at the base, rising as a green curtain. The bearded man saw a tiny object moving across the face of the water. Then the wall swept over him and his flock. Gil rested face down on the board, thinking slow thoughts, waiting with the others for the one big wave. Water sloshed under his belly. Hot sunlight broiled his back. Other surfboards bobbed in a line on either side of him. Janine caught his eye and smiled a lazy smile full of promises and memories. Her husband would be out of town for 3 more days. Gil's answering grin said nothing. He was waiting for a wave. There wouldn't be very good waves here at Santa Monica's Muscle Beach, but Janine's apartment was near, and there'd be other waves on other days. The houses and apartments on the bluff above bobbed up and down. They looked bright and new, not like the houses on Malibu Beach where the buildings always looked older than they were. Yet even here there were signs of age. Entropy ran fast at the line between sea and land. Gil was young, like all the young men bobbing on the water this fine morning. He was 17, burned brown, his longish hair bleached nearly white, belly muscles like the discreet plates of an armadillo. He was glad to look older than he was. He hadn't needed to pay for a place to stay or food to eat since his father threw him out of the house. There were always older women. If he thought about Janine's husband, it was with friendly amusement. He was no threat to the man. He wanted nothing permanent. She could be making out with some guy who'd want her money on a permanent basis. He squinted against the brilliance. It flared, and he closed his eyes. That was a reflex. Wave reflections were a common thing out here. The flare died against his closed eyelids, and he looked out to sea. Wave coming? He saw a fiery cloud lift beyond the horizon. He studied it, squinting, making himself believe. "Big wave coming," he called, and rose to his knees. Corey called, "Where?" "You'll see it," Gil called confidently. He turned his board and paddled out to sea, bending almost until his cheek touched the board, using long, deep sweeps of his long arms. He was scared shitless, but nobody would ever know it. "Wait for me," Janine called. Gil continued paddling. Others followed, but only the strongest could keep up. Corey pulled abreast of him. "I saw the fireball," he shouted. He panted with effort. "It's Lucifer's hammer. Tidal wave." Gil said nothing. Talk was discouraged out here, but the others jabbered among themselves, and Gil paddled even faster, leaving them. A man ought to be alone during a thing like this. He was beginning to grasp the fact of death. Rain came, and he paddled on. He glanced back to see the houses and bluff receding, going uphill, leaving an enormous stretch of new beach, gleaming wet. Lightning flared along the hills above Malibu. The hills had changed. The orderly buildings of Santa Monica had tumbled into heaps. The horizon went up. Death, inevitable. If death was inevitable, what was left? Style. Only style. Gil went on paddling, riding the receding waters until motion was gone. He was a long way out now. He turned his board and waited. Others caught up and turned, spread across hundreds of yards in the rainy waters. If they spoke, Gil couldn't hear them. There was a terrifying rumble behind him. Gil waited a moment longer, then paddled like mad, sure, deep strokes, doing it well and truly. He was sliding downhill, down the big green wall, and the water was lifting hard beneath him, so that he rested on knees and elbows with the blood pouring into his face, bugging his eyes, starting a nosebleed. The pressure was enormous, unbearable. Then it eased. With the speed he'd gained, he turned the board, scooting down and sideways along the nearly vertical wall, balancing on knees. He stood up. He needed more angle. More. If he could reach the peak of the wave, he'd be out of it. He could actually live through this. Ride it out. Ride it out and do it well. Other boards had turned, too. He saw them ahead of him, above and below on the green wall. Corey had turned the wrong way. He shot beneath Gil's feet, moving faster than hell and looking terrified. They swept toward the bluff. They were higher than the bluff. The beach house and the Santa Monica Pier with its carousel and all the yachts anchored nearby slid beneath the waters. Then they were looking down on streets and cars. Gil had a momentary glimpse of a bearded man kneeling with others. Then the waters swept on past. The base of the wall was churning chaos, white foam and swirling debris and thrashing bodies and tumbling cars. Below him now was Santa Monica Boulevard. The wave swept over the mall, adding the wreckage of shops and shoppers and potted trees and bicycles to the crashing foam below. As the wave engulfed each low building, he braced himself for the shock, squatting low. The board slammed against his feet, and he nearly lost it. He saw Tommy Schumacher engulfed, gone, his board bounding high and whirling crazily. Only two boards left now. The wave's frothing peak was far, far above him. The churning base was much too close. His legs shrieked in the agony of exhaustion. One board left ahead of him, ahead and below. Who? It didn't matter. He saw it dip into chaos. Gone. Gil risked a quick look back. Nobody there. He was alone on the ultimate wave. Oh, God, if he lived to tell this tale, what a movie it would make. Bigger than The Endless Summer. Bigger than The Towering Inferno. A surfing movie with 10 million in special effects. If only his legs would hold. He already had a world record. He must be at least a mile inland. No one had ever ridden a wave for a mile. But the frothing, purling peak was miles overhead. And the Barrington Apartments, 30 stories tall, was coming at him like a flyswatter. What was once a comet is a pitiful remnant, a double handful of flying hills and boulders of dirty ice. Earth's gravitational field has spread them across the sky. They may still reach the halo, but they can never rejoin. Craters glow across the face of the earth. The sea strikes glow as brightly as the land strikes, but the sea strikes are growing smaller. Walls of water hover around them, edging inward. The water hovers 2 miles high around the Pacific Strike. Its edges boil frantically. The pressure of expanding live steam holds back the walls of water. And the hot vapor goes up in a column clear as glass, carrying salt from vaporized seawater and silt from the sea bottom, and recondensed rock from the strike itself. At the limits of Earth's atmosphere, it begins to spread in an expanding whirlpool. Megatons of live steam begin to cool. Water condenses first around dust and larger particles. What falls out of the pattern are the heavier globules of mud. Some join as they fall. They are still hot. In the drier air below, some water evaporates. Hammerfall 2. Oh, Cinnaman, where are you going to run to? Oh, Cinnaman, where are you going to run to? Oh, Cinnaman, where are you going to run to? All on that day. The TV store was closed. It wouldn't open for an hour. Tim Hamner searched frantically, a bar, a barbershop, any place that might have TV, but he saw nothing. He thought fleetingly of taxis, but that was silly. Los Angeles taxis didn't cruise. They'd come if you called them, but it might be forever. No, he wasn't going to get to JPL, and Hamner Brown's nucleus must be passing right now. The astronauts would see it all and send their films down to Earth, and Tim Hamner wouldn't see any of it. The police had removed some of the wardens, but that had no effect on the traffic jam. Too many abandoned cars. And now what? Tim thought. Maybe I can... It was as if a flash bulb had gone off behind him. Blink and gone. Tim blinked. What exactly had he seen? There was nothing to the south but the green-brown hills of Griffith Park, with 2 horseback riders trotting along the trail. Tim frowned, then thoughtfully walked back toward his car. There was a telephone in it, and he might as well summon a taxi. 2 white-robed wardens, one with red trim on a tailor-made robe, came toward him. Tim avoided them. They stopped another pedestrian.
Pray, ye people, it is even now the hour, but it is not yet too late.
The horns and shouts of anger had reached a crescendo when he got to his car. The earth moved. A sudden, sharp motion, then something more gentle. Buildings shook. A plate glass window crashed somewhere nearby. There were more sounds of falling glass. Tim could hear them because the car horns were suddenly quiet. It was as if everyone were frozen in place. A few people came out of the supermarket. Others stood in doorways, ready to get outside if it continued. Then nothing. The horns began. People were yelling and screaming. Tim unlocked the car and reached inside for the radio phone. The earth moved again. There were more sounds of falling glass, and someone screamed. Then once again, silence. A flight of crows came winging out of the wooded patch at the corner of the Disney lot. They screamed at the people below, but no one paid any attention. The seconds stretched on, and the horns were once again beginning to sound when Tim was thrown violently to the asphalt parking lot. This time it didn't stop. The ground shook and rolled and shook again, and whenever Tim tried to get up, he was thrown down again, and it seemed that it would never stop. The chair was on its back under a pile of catalogs, and Eileen was in it. Her head hurt. Her skirt was around her hips. She rolled out of the chair very slowly and carefully, because there was shattered glass all the hell over the place, and pulled her skirt down. Her nylons were in ruins. There was a long, thin smear of blood along her left calf, and she watched, afraid to touch the spot, until she was certain there was no more blood coming out of her leg. The front office was a chaos of catalogs, broken glass coffee table, tumbled shelving, and the remains of the big plate glass window. She shook her head dizzily. Silly thoughts boiled in her head. How could one window have had so much glass? Then, as her head cleared, she realized that each of those heavy shelves and their books had missed her head as it fell. She sagged against the receptionist's desk, dizzy. She saw Joe Corrigan. The plate glass window had fallen inward, and Corrigan had been sitting next to it. Pieces of glass lay all about him. Eileen staggered to him and knelt, cutting her knee on a glass sliver. A dagger-sized glass lance had gouged his cheek and bitten deep into his throat. Blood pooled beneath the wound, but there was no more flowing out. His eyes and mouth were wide open. Eileen pulled the glass splinter free. She covered the wound with her palm, surprised that it wasn't bleeding more. What do you do about a throat wound? There were police outside. One of them would know. She took a deep breath, made ready to scream. Then she listened. There were plenty of people screaming. Others were shouting. The noises from outside were chaotic. People and rumbling sounds, as if buildings were still falling. Automobile horns, at least two, jammed on, not quite steady, wavering in mechanical agony. Nobody was going to hear Eileen call for help. She looked down at Corrigan. She couldn't feel a pulse. She probed at the other side of his neck. No pulse there. She found a tuft of fuzz from the rug and put it on his nostrils. It didn't even quiver. But that's crazy, she thought. The neck wound couldn't have killed him, not yet. He was dead, though. Heart attack? She got up slowly. Salt tears rolled down her cheek. They had the taste of dust. Automatically, she brushed at her hair and her skirt before going outside, and she felt an impulse to laugh. She choked it down. If she started that, she wouldn't stop. There were more sounds from out there. Ugly sounds, but she had to get outside. There were police outside, and one was Eric Larson. She started to call him, then she saw what was happening, and she stood quietly in the ruined doorway. Patrolman Eric Larson was from Kansas. To him, the earthquake was completely disorienting, completely terrifying. His urge was to run in circles, flapping his arms and squawking. He couldn't even get to his feet. He tried and was thrown down each time, and presently decided to stay there. He put his head in his arms and closed his eyes. He tried to think of the TV script he could write when this was over, but he couldn't concentrate. There was noise. The earth groaned like an angry bull. That's a poetic image. Where did I hear it? But there was more. Cars crashing, buildings crashing, concrete falling, and everywhere, people screaming, some in fear, some in rage, some just screaming. Eventually, the ground stopped moving. Eric Larson opened his eyes. His world had come apart. Buildings were broken or tilted, cars wrecked, the street itself buckled and crumpled. The parking lot was a jigsaw of asphalt at crazy angles. The supermarket across the street had fallen in on itself, walls collapsing, roof tumbled. People dragged themselves out of it. Still, Eric waited, willing to take his lead from the natives. Tornadoes in Kansas, earthquakes in California. The natives would know what to do. But they didn't. They stood, those few remaining, blinking in the bright, cloudless summer day, or they lay on the ground in bloody heaps, or they screamed and ran in circles. Eric looked for his partner. Regulation blue trousers and black shoes protruded from under a load of plumbing supplies fallen from a truck. A crate labeled Silent Flush stood where the head should have been. The crate was very flat on the ground. Eric shuddered and got to his feet. He couldn't go near that crate, not just yet. He started toward the supermarket, wondering when the ambulances would come, looking for a senior officer to tell him what to do. Three burly men in flannel shirts stood near a station wagon. One walked completely around it, inspecting for damage. The wagon was heavily loaded. A porch with a railing of ornamental iron scrollwork had dropped through the back end. The men cursed loudly. One dug into the back of the wagon. He took out shotguns and handed them to his friends. "We won't get out of here because of those motherfuckers." The man's voice was quiet and strangely calm. Eric could barely hear him. The others nodded and began thrusting shells into their guns. They didn't look back at Eric Larson. When the guns were loaded, the three raised them to their shoulders and aimed at a dozen wardens. The white-robed preachers screamed and pulled at their chains. Then the shotguns went off in volley. Eric put his hand to his pistol, then drew it away quickly. Hell. He walked toward the men, his knees unsteady. They were reloading. "Don't do that," Eric said. The men jumped at the voice. They turned to see Police Blue. They frowned, their eyes wide, their expressions uncertain. Eric stared back. He had already noticed the "Support Your Local Police" bumper sticker on the station wagon. The oldest of the three men snorted. "It's over! That was the end of civilization you just saw! Don't you understand?" And suddenly, Eric did understand. There weren't going to be any ambulances to take the injured to hospitals. Startled, Eric looked back down Alameda, toward the place where St. Joseph's was. He saw nothing but buckled streets and collapsed houses. Had St. Joseph's been visible from here? Eric couldn't remember. The spokesman for the men was still shouting.
"Those motherfuckers kept us from getting up into the hills. What use are they?"
He looked down at his empty shotgun. It lay open in his hand. His other hand held two shells and kept straying toward the breech of the gun, not quite inserting them. "I don't know," Eric said. "Are you going to be the first man to start shooting policemen?" He let his eyes go to the bumper sticker. The burly man's followed, then looked down at the street.
"Are you?"
Eric repeated.
"No."
"Good. Now give me the shotgun."
"I need it."
"So do I," Eric said. "Your friends have others."
"Am I under arrest?"
"Where would I take you?" "I need your shotgun, that's all." The man nodded.
"Okay."
"The shells, too," Eric said. His voice took on a note of urgency.
"All right.
Now get out of here," Eric said. He held the shotgun without loading it. The wardens, the few that survived, watched in silent horror. "Thank you," Eric said. He turned away, not caring where the burly men went. "I've just watched Murder One and done nothing about it," he told himself. He walked briskly away from the traffic jam. It was as if his mind were no longer connected to his body, and his body knew where it was going. The sky to the southwest was strange. Clouds flew overhead, formed and vanished as in a speeded-up film. It was all familiar to Eric Larson, as familiar as the way the air felt in his sinuses. Anyone from Topeka would know. Tornado weather. When the air feels like this, and the sky looks that way, you head for the nearest basement, taking a radio and a canteen of water. It's a good mile to the Burbank City Jail, Eric thought. He studied the sky judiciously. I can make it. He walked briskly toward the jail. Eric Larson was still a civilized man. Eileen watched the incident in horror. She hadn't heard the conversation, but what happened was plain enough. The police weren't police any longer. Two of the wardens were messily dead. Five more writhed in the agony of mortal wounds, and the rest were writhing to free themselves from the chains. One of the wardens had a pair of bolt cutters. Eileen recognized them. Joe Corrigan had given them to the police only minutes, or lifetimes, before. The scene outside was incomprehensible. People lay in heaps or dragged themselves from ruined shops. One man had climbed on top of a wrecked truck. He sat on the cab, feet dangling over the windshield, and drank deeply from a bottle of whiskey. Every now and again he looked up and laughed. Anyone wearing a white robe was in danger. For the wardens in chains, it was a nightmare. Hundreds of enraged drivers, more hundreds of passengers, many fleeing the city, not really expecting Hammerfall, but heading out just in case. And the wardens had stopped them. Most of the people in the street were still lying flat on their backs or wandering aimlessly, but there were enough, men and women converging on the robed and chained wardens, and each carrying something heavy, tire irons, tire chains, jack handles, a baseball bat. Eileen stood in the doorway. She glanced back at Corrigan's body. Two vertical lines deepened between her eyes as she watched Patrolman Larson's retreating back. A riot was starting out there, and the only cop was walking away, fast, after calmly watching murder. It wasn't a world Eileen understood. World. What had happened to the world? Gingerly, she picked her way back through the broken glass toward her office. Thank God for medium heels, she thought. Glass crunched underfoot. She moved as quickly as she could, without a glance at the smashed goods and broken shelves and sagging walls. A length of pipe, torn loose from the ceiling, had half-crushed her desk, smashing the glass top. The pipe was heavier than anything she had ever lifted before, and she grunted with the effort, but it moved. She pulled her purse from underneath, then scrambled about looking for the portable radio. It seemed undamaged. Nothing but static. She thought she heard a few words in the static, someone shouting, "Hammerfall," over and over again, or was that in her head? No matter, there was no useful information. Or rather, there was, in that fact itself. This wasn't a local disaster. The San Andreas had let go. Okay, but there were plenty of radio stations in Southern California, and not all of them were near the fault. One or more should still be broadcasting, and Eileen knew of nothing an earthquake could do that would cause so much static. Static. She went on through the back of the store. She found another body there, one of the warehousemen. She knew from the coveralls. There wouldn't have been any point in looking for a face, or for an upper torso either, not under that. The door to the alley was jammed. She pulled, and it moved slightly. And she pulled again, bracing her cut knee against the wall and straining as hard as she could. It opened just far enough to let her squeeze through, and she went out and looked up at the sky. Black clouds, roiling, and rain beginning to fall. Salt rain. Lightning flashed overhead. The alley was blocked with rubble. Her car couldn't possibly get through. She stopped and used the mirror from her purse. Found a Kleenex and wiped away the dirty tear streaks and blood. Not that it mattered a damn how she looked, but it made her feel better. More rain fell. Darkness and lightning overhead and salt rain. What did that mean? A big ocean strike? Tim had tried to tell her, but she hadn't listened. It had so little to do with real life. She thought about Tim as she hurried down the alley, back toward Alameda because it was the only way she could go. And when she got to the street, she couldn't believe what she was seeing. Tim was there, in the middle of a riot. The earthquake rolled Tim Hamner under his car. He stayed there, waiting for the next shock, until he smelled gasoline. Then he came out fast, crawling across the buckled pavement, staying on hands and knees. He heard screams of terror and agony, and new sounds. Concrete smashing on street pavement, concrete punching through metal car bodies, an endless tinkle of falling glass. And still he couldn't believe. He got up, trembling. People in white robes, blue uniforms, street clothes, lay sprawled on shattered street and sidewalks. Some moved, some did not. Some were obviously dead, twisted or crushed. Cars had been overturned or smashed together or crushed by falling masonry. No building stood intact. The smell of gasoline was strong in his nostrils. He reached for a cigarette, jerked his hand violently away, then thoughtfully put his lighter in a back pocket where he'd have to think before finding it. A three-story building had lost its east face. The glass and brick had disintegrated, spilling outward across the parking lot and side street almost as far as where Tim Hamner had been lying. A chunk with part of a bay window in it had dropped through the passenger section of Hamner's car. Gasoline ran from it in a spreading pool. From somewhere he heard screams. He tried to shut them out. He couldn't think of anything to do. Then the riot spilled around the corner. It was led by three men in white robes. They were not screaming. They were panting and saving all their breath for it. The screaming came from those behind them, and not from those in the lead. One of the robed ones screamed at last. "Help! Please!" he screamed at Tim Hamner and ran toward him. The mob pursued. They were looking at Tim Hamner, all those eyes at once, and he thought, "They'll believe I'm with them." Then a worse thought. I could be recognized as the man who invented the hammer. Time was too short to consider the idea. Tim reached into the trunk and brought out the portable tape unit. The robed youth running toward him had a wispy blonde beard and a lean face set in classic lines of terror. Tim shoved his microphone toward the warden and said loudly, "One moment, please, sir. Just how..." Insulted and betrayed, the man swiped at the microphone and ran past him. The other two fugitives and most of the mob had continued on down the street, toward the dead end, and of course that was a pity. Some burly types ran past Tim, chasing the robed man into the broken building. One stopped, panting, and looked at Tim. Hamner lifted the microphone again. "Sir, have you any idea how all this happened?"
"Hell yes, buddy. Those sons of bitches, those wardens blocked us off just as we were taking off for Big Bear. They were going to stop the comet by praying. Didn't work, and they trapped us here, and we've already killed about half of the motherfuckers."
It was working. Somehow, nobody ever thinks of killing a newsman. Too vividly public, maybe. The whole world is watching. Other rioters had stopped, were crowding around, but not as if they were waiting their turn to kill Tim Hamner. They were waiting for a chance to speak.
"Who you with?" one demanded.
"KNBS," Tim said. He fumbled in his pockets for the press card Harvey Randall had given him. There it was. Tim flashed it, but kept his thumb over the name.
"Can you get a message out?" the man demanded. "Send for..."
Tim shook his head. "This is a recorder, not a remote unit. The rest of the crew will be here soon, I hope." He turned back to the first man. "How are you planning to get out now?"
"Don't know. Walk out, I guess."
He seemed to have lost interest in the fleeing wardens.
"Thank you, sir. Would you mind signing..."
Tim brought out a stack of NBS release forms. The big man stepped back as if they'd been scorpions. He looked thoughtful for a second.
"Forget it, buddy."
He turned and walked away. Others followed, and the whole crowd melted away, leaving Tim alone by the ruins of his car. Hamner put the press card into his shirt pocket, adjusting it so that the big lettering, "Press," was visible, but his name wasn't. Then he put the recorder's strap over his shoulder. He also carried the microphone and a stack of release forms. It was all heavy and awkward, but it was worth it. He did not laugh. Alameda was filled with horrors. A woman dressed in an expensive pantsuit was jumping up and down on a lumpy white robe. Tim looked away. When he looked back, there were more people swarming around him.
They carried bloody tire irons. A man swung toward him, swung an enormous handgun toward Tim's navel. Tim pointed the microphone at him. "Excuse me, sir, how did you manage to get trapped in this mess?" The man cried as he told his tale. There was someone at Tim's elbow. Hamner hesitated, not wanting to look away. The man with the gun was still talking, tears of rage running down his face, and his gun still pointed at Tim's navel. He looked earnestly into Hamner's eyes. Whatever he saw, he hadn't fired yet. Who the devil was that? Someone reaching for the release forms. Eileen. Eileen Hancock? Tim held the microphone motionless as Eileen stepped briskly to his side. He let her take the release forms. "Okay, Chief, I'm here," she said. "A bit of trouble back there." Tim almost fainted. She wasn't going to blow his cover. Thank God she had brains for that. Tim nodded, his eyes still fixed on his interview subject. "Glad you got here," Tim said from the corner of his mouth, speaking low as if worried about ruining the interview. He did not smile.
"And if I see another of the sons of bitches, I'll kill him too."
"Thank you, sir," Tim said gravely. "I don't suppose you'd care to sign..."
"Sign? Sign what?"
"A release form." The gun swung up to point at Tim's face.
"You bastard!"
the man screamed. "Anonymous subject," Eileen said. "Sir, you do know there's a newsperson's shield law in California, don't you?"
"What?"
"We can't be forced to reveal our sources," Eileen said. "You don't need to worry. It's the law."
"Oh,"
the man looked around. The other rioters had gone somewhere, and it was raining. He looked at Tim and at Eileen and at the gun in his hand. There were more tears. Then he turned and walked away. After a few steps, he ran. Somewhere a woman screamed, short and sharp. The background noise was screams and moans and thunder. Thunder always, and very near. A brisk wind had risen. Two men were atop an intact car with a shoulder-carried television camera. No way to tell how long they'd been there, but they were all alone on an island of privacy. And so were Tim and Eileen. "Rioters are publicity shy," Tim said. "Glad to see you. I'd forgotten you work around here."
"Worked," Eileen said. She pointed toward the ruins of Corrigan's. "I don't suppose anyone will be selling plumbing supplies."
"Not from Burbank," Tim said.
"I am glad to see you. You know that, don't you? What do we do now?"
"You're the expert." Lightning crackled nearby. The hills of Griffith Park were aflame with blue flashes.
"High ground," Tim said, "and fast."
Eileen looked puzzled. She pointed at the lightning.
"That might hit us," he agreed, "but we've a better chance out of this river valley. Feel the rain. And there may be..."
"Yes?"
"Tidal wave," Tim said. "Jesus, it's real, isn't it?"
"This way, then, up into the Verdugo Hills. We can hike across. How much time do we have?" "I don't know. Depends on where it hit. They hit, probably." Tim was surprised at how calm his voice was. Eileen began walking, east on Alameda. The route led toward the head of the traffic jam where the huddled bodies of the wardens lay. As they got near, a car roared off through the intersection, into a filling station beyond, then onto the sidewalk. It squeezed through between a wall and a telephone pole, scraping paint off the right side. The car that had been behind it was now clear, and it was unlocked. Keys dangled in the ignition. Eileen waved Tim toward it.
"How good a driver are you?" she demanded.
"Okay." "I'll drive," she said firmly. "I'm damned good at it." She got into the driver's seat and started the car. It was an elderly Chrysler, once a luxury car. Now the rugs were worn, and it had ugly stains on the seat covers. When the motor turned over with a steady purr, Tim thought it the most beautiful car he'd ever seen. Eileen took the route of the previous car. They drove over a white robe, bump. She didn't slow. The space between the telephone pole and the wall was narrow, but she went through it at speed, 20 miles an hour anyway, without worrying about it. Tim held his breath until they were through. The street curved gently ahead of them.
There were cars jammed in both lanes of traffic, and Eileen kept on the sidewalk, veering off into yards when she had to avoid more utility poles. She drove through rose beds and manicured lawns until they were past the traffic jam.
"Lord God, you are a good driver," Tim said.
Eileen didn't look up. She was busy avoiding obstructions. Some of the obstructions were people.
"Should we warn them?" she asked.
"Would it do any good?" "But yes," Tim said. He opened the window on his side. The rain was coming down hard now, and the salt stung his eyes.
"Get to high ground," he shouted. "Tidal waves, flood, get to high ground," he shouted into the rising wind.
People stared at him as they went by. A few looked around wildly, and once Tim saw a man grab a woman and dash for a car in sudden decision. They turned a corner, and there were red flames. A whole block of houses was burning out of control, burning despite the rain. The wind blew flaming chips into the air. Another time they slowed to avoid rubble in the street. A woman ran toward them carrying a bundled blanket. Before Eileen could accelerate, the woman had reached the car. She thrust the blanket in the window.
"His name is John," she shouted. "Take care of him."
"But don't you want—"
Tim couldn't finish. The woman had turned away.
"Two more back there," she screamed. "John! John Mason! Remember his name!"
Eileen speeded up again. Tim opened the bundle. There was a baby in it. It didn't move. Tim felt for a heartbeat, and his hand came out covered with blood. It was bright red, copper blood, and the smell filled the car despite the warm salt smell of the rain.
"Dead," Tim said.
"Throw him out," Eileen said. "But we aren't going to eat him. We won't be that hungry."
It shocked Tim so much that he thrust the baby out the window and let go.
It felt like I was letting some of my life drop onto that pavement," he said. "Do you think I like it?"
Eileen's voice was pinched. Tim looked at her in alarm. There were tears streaming down her cheeks.
"That woman thinks she saved her child. At least she thinks that. It's all we could have done for her."
"Yes," Tim said gently.
When we've got to high ground, when we know what's happening, we can start thinking civilization again," Eileen said. "Until then, we survive."
"If we can, we will." She drove on, grimly. The rain was coming down so hard that she couldn't see, despite the windshield wipers speeding away, smearing grime and salt water across the windshield. The Golden State Freeway had cracked. The underpass was blocked with wreckage. A tangle of cars and a large gasoline tank truck lay in the midst of a spreading pool of fire.
"Jesus," Tim said. Shouldn't we stop?" "What for?"
Eileen turned left and drove parallel to the freeway.
"Anyone who's going to survive that has got out already."
They were driving through a residential area. The houses had mostly survived intact. They both felt relief. For a few moments, there was no one hurt, broken, or dying. They found another underpass, and Eileen drove toward it. The way had been blocked by a traffic barrier. Someone had torn down the barrier. Eileen drove through it. As she did, another car came out of the rain ahead. It dashed past, horns screaming.
"Why would anyone be going into the valley?" Tim demanded. "Wives, sweethearts, children," Eileen said.
They were climbing now. When the way was blocked by twisted remains of buildings and cars, Eileen turned left, bearing north and east always. They passed the ruins of a hospital. Police in blue, nurses in rain-soaked white poked at the wreckage. One of the policemen stopped and looked at them. Tim leaned out the window and screamed at him,
"Get to high ground! Flood! Tidal wave! High ground!"
The policeman waved, then turned back to the wreckage of the hospital. Tim stared moodily at the swirling smears on the windshield. He blinked back tears of his own. Eileen had a moment to glance at him. Her hand touched his before returning to the wheel.
"We couldn't have helped. They've got cars and enough people."
"I guess." He wondered if he meant it. The nightmare ride went on as the car climbed toward the Verdugo Hills, past wrecked stucco houses, a fallen school, burning houses, and intact houses. Whenever they saw anyone, Tim screamed warning. It made him feel a little better for not stopping. He glanced at his watch. Incredibly, less than 40 minutes had passed since he'd seen the bright flash. He muttered it. 40 minutes. H plus 40 minutes, and counting. The wave rushes outward from the center of the Gulf of Mexico, moving at 760 miles an hour. When it reaches the shallows along the coast of Texas and Louisiana, the foot of the wave stumbles. More and more water rushes up behind, piling higher and higher, until a towering monster half a kilometer high falls forward and flows up onto the land. Galveston and Texas City vanish under the pounding waves. The water that flows westward through the swamps into El Lago, further west into Houston itself, is now filled with debris. The wave strikes all along the arc, from Brownsville, Texas, to Pensacola, Florida, seeking lowlands, rivers, any path inland and away from the burning hell at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. The waters pile high along the Florida west coast, then they break across, carrying with them the sandy soil. They leave behind channels, scoured clean, a myriad of passages from the Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean. The Gulf Stream will be cooler and much smaller for centuries to come. The waters crossing Florida are capricious. Here, a reflected wave joins the main body of rushing water to build even higher. There, a reflection cancels, leaving parts of the Okefenokee Swamp untouched. Havana and the Florida Keys vanish instantly. Miami enjoys an hour's respite until the waves from the Atlantic strikes rush down, meet the outrushing waves from the Gulf, overpower them, and crash into Florida's eastern cities. Atlantic waters pour into the Gulf of Mexico through the newly formed Cross Florida channels. The saucer bowl of the Gulf cannot hold it all, and the waters once again flow west and north across the already drowned lands. One wave rushes up the Mississippi. It is 40 feet above flood level when it passes Memphis, Tennessee. Fred Lauren had been at the window all night. The bars didn't hide the sky at all. They'd put him alone in a cell after they'd photographed and fingerprinted him, and they left him. At noon, he'd be taken to the Los Angeles jail. Fred laughed. At noon, there wouldn't be a Los Angeles jail. There'd be no Los Angeles. They'd never get a chance to put him in with those other men. Memories of another prison came, and he swept them away with better thoughts. He remembered Colleen. He'd gone to her door with presents. He only wanted to talk. She'd been afraid of him, but he was inside before she could bolt the door, and he'd brought very nice presents for her, nice enough that she'd let him stand by the door while she stood on the other side of the room and looked at the jewelry and the gloves and red shoes. And then she'd wondered how he knew her sizes, and he told her. He'd talked and talked, and after a while she was friendly and let him sit down. She'd offered him a drink, and they'd talked some more, and she had 2 drinks for herself, and then another. She'd been pleased that he knew so much about her. He didn't tell her about the telescope, of course, but he'd told her how he knew where she worked, and where she shopped, and how beautiful she was. Fred didn't want to remember the rest of it. How she'd had 1 drink too many, and told him that even though they'd just met, she felt she'd known him a long time. And, of course, he really had known her, even if she didn't know it, and she'd asked if he wanted to stay. Tramp. Like all of them. A tramp. No, she couldn't have been. She really loved him. He knew she did. But why had she laughed, and then screamed and told him to get out when... No. Fred always stopped remembering then. He looked up at the sky. The comet was there. Its tail blazed across the sky, just as he'd seen in the paintings in the astronomy magazines, and when the sky was blue, with hidden dawn brightening in that tiny patch of western sky that Fred could see, there were still the wisps of comet among the clouds, and people moved on the streets below. The fools, didn't they know? They brought him breakfast in his cell. The jailers didn't want to talk to him. Even the trustees looked at him that way. They knew. They knew. The police doctors must have examined her, and they knew she hadn't been, that he couldn't, that he'd tried, but he couldn't, and she laughed, and he knew how he could do it, but he didn't want to, and she laughed again, and he bit her until she screamed, and then he'd be able to, only she kept on screaming. He had to stop thinking. He had to, before he remembered the shape on the bed. The cops had made him look at her. One had held his hand in a certain way, and bent his fingers until he opened his eyes and looked, and he didn't want to. Didn't they understand that he loved her, and he didn't want... The sky glowed strangely through the cracks of the buildings across the street. Somewhere to the left, far south and west, the glow died before he'd seen anything at all, but Fred smiled. It had happened. It wouldn't be long now.
"Hey, Charlie,"
the drunk across the block called.
"Charlie?"
"Yeah,"
the trustee answered.
"What the fuck was that? They making movies out there?"
"Don't know what you're talking about. Ask the sex maniac. He's got Western exposure."
"Hey, sex maniac!"
The walls and floor jerked suddenly, savagely. He was flying. He threw out his arms to ward the wall from his head. The stone wave broke against his arms, and Fred howled. Agony screamed in his left elbow. The floor seemed to stabilize. The jail was solidly built. There'd been nothing damaged. Fred moved his left arm and moaned. Other prisoners were shouting now. One screamed in agony. He must have fallen from an upper bunk. Fred ignored them all and moved again to the window. He felt real fear. Was that all? One ordinary day with clouds. Jesus, they were moving fast. Churning, forming, and vanishing, streaming north and west. A lower cloud bank, calmer and more stable, began moving south and west. This wasn't what Fred had expected. One wave of fire, that was what he had prepared for. Doomsday was taking its own sweet time. The sky darkened. Now it was all black clouds, swirling, churning, flashing with continuous lightning. The wind and the thunder howled louder than the prisoners. The end of the world came in blinding light and simultaneous thunderclap. Fred's mind recondensed to find him on the floor. His elbow was shrieking agony. Lightning. Lightning must have struck the jail itself. There were no lights in the corridor, and outside was dark, so that he could see only in surrealistic flashes like a strobe-lit go-go bar. Charlie was moving along the cell block. He carried keys. He was letting the prisoners out, one by one. He opened the cells, and they came out and moved down the corridor, and he had already passed Fred's cell. The cells on either side were open. His was locked. Fred screamed. Charlie didn't turn. He went on until he reached the end of the cell block, then he went out and down the stairs. Fred was alone. Eric Larson looked to neither the right nor the left. He walked in long strides. He stepped around the dead and the injured and ignored pleas for help. He could have helped them, but he was driven by a terrible urgency. His cold eyes and the carelessly carried shotgun discouraged anyone from getting in his way. He saw no other policeman. He barely noticed the people around him, that some were helping the injured, some were disconsolately staring at the ruins of their homes and shops and stores, some were running aimlessly. None of it mattered now. They were all doomed, as Eric Larson was doomed. He might have taken a car and driven away into the hills. He saw cars race past him. He saw Eileen Hancock in an old Chrysler. If she'd stopped, he might have gone with her, but she didn't, and Eric was glad, because it was tough enough to keep his resolve. But suppose he wasn't needed, suppose it was a fool's errand. There was no way to know. But I should have taken a car, he thought. I could have finished it and had a chance. Too late now. There was the station house, city hall, and the jail. They seemed deserted. He went into the jail. There was a dead policewoman under the wreckage of a huge cabinet that had stood against the wall. He saw no one else, living or dead. He went through behind the booking cage and up the stairs. The cell blocks were quiet. It was a fool's errand. He was not needed. He was about to go back down the stairs, but he stopped himself. No point in coming this far without being sure. There'd been talk of a tidal wave following Hammerfall. There were people in the Burbank jail, people that Eric Larson had put there. Drunks, petty thieves, young vagrants who said they were 18 but looked much younger. They couldn't be left to drown like rats in forgotten jail cells.